This is the Walking Home from the ICU podcast. I'm Kaylee Dayton, a nurse practitioner and ICU consultant. I help teams create awake and walking ICUs through evidence-based sedation and mobility practices. By hearing from survivors, clinicians, and researchers, we'll explore how to give ICU patients the best chance to walk out of the ICU and go home to survive and thrive. Welcome to the ICU Revolution. Throughout this podcast, we've heard many perspectives of severe delirium and the horrors of severe ICU cord weakness. We know that up to 80% of ICU patients suffer from delirium. The belief has been that patients will not have bad experiences if we exclude them from the real experiences of the ICU. That is usually far from reality. Yet, what about patients that don't have terrible experiences while sedated? I'm excited to bring in an intensivist that shares her personal journey through COVID and why she is a passionate advocate for delirium protocols and early mobility. Dr. Vanderwood, thank you so much for coming to the podcast. Can you introduce yourself? And I know I'm not saying your name right, so say your name perfectly for everyone.
Yeah. Hi, Kaylee. Thanks for the invitation. I'm really honored to be in this podcast as a European guest. My name is Meta van der Wouden, and I'm an intensivist in the Netherlands. And I've worked for more than 20 years as an intensive care physician in a 28-bed ICU in the Netherlands, in the southern part. And my main topics of interest are mechanical ventilation and delirium. And furthermore, I used to be responsible for the post-ICU follow-up clinic in our hospital, where we saw former ICU patients and their family 3 months after their discharge from the hospital. And at this moment, I work as a teacher for ICU nurses and as a researcher.
Excellent. And before you started working with patients and had some personal experiences, which we'll get into, when you started your career and most patients on the ventilator were sedated, what was your understanding and your perspective of sedation?
When I began with my career, it was usual that all patients were fully sedated and sometimes even fixated for many days. And it was difficult to tell and explain to the nurses that deep sedation was not necessary, but even that the deep relaxation and the continuous relaxation during days not necessary was, because patients will not jump out of the bed when they are laying on a ventilator. But it was real a new mindset what we had to go in. And during the 20 years of my work in the ICU, we have patients more awake and we really less sedative in the patients. Only during the nights when they were delirious, you will get questions from nurses who are asking them, oh, can you give them some propofol that they have a nice sleep and they are being quiet for the night?
And now what's your perspective? I mean, now you have a very invested interest in delirium. So that must change a lot of things for you as far as how you see it. How did you become so interested in delirium?
Now, in the past, the focus in ICU was mainly on the survival of the patient. And delirium was very difficult to recognize. And it seemed to be more or less part of the deal for being an ICU patient that you also got a delirium. And it was also not recognized as being harmful for patients. And until the beginning of this century, it became clear that experience had consequences, negative consequences. And it was in that time that I got interested in this topic. So I started with introducing in our ICU the pain, agitation, and delirium guidelines. And I collaborated also in some research in delirium prevention. And I found out that we used MICU, that is very difficult. And there's also a high barrier sometimes to do those kind of assessments. Yeah, even and especially when it's very busy in the ICU, people, nurses won't do the CHEM ICU assessment. For example, during COVID time, I think hardly no one was assessed on delirium.
And I see here in the States, a lot of our newer nurses that came in during COVID, they haven't really been taught how to do the CHEM. or at least it's not reinforced. And so when I'm training teams, that's a big gap that I notice, is that they say, yeah, we know how to do the CAM. And I don't think they're intending to be dishonest, but I don't think they don't know what they don't know. So when we actually practice it is when we realize that they haven't really been instructed on how to do it the proper way. And so it's hard now to really trust our delirium rates when we are not really screening for them appropriately. And what's your personal experience with delirium?
My personal experience. Maybe I have to start when how I did enter the ICU as a patient myself.
Absolutely.
Then I will first start with a sketch of the situation in the Netherlands in 2020. So at the end of February 2020, we got the first COVID-19 patient in the Netherlands in the hospital. And on March 5th, our first COVID-19 patient was admitted to our ICU. And from that moment on, we got more and more patients day by day. And for me, for myself, I wasn't afraid of getting COVID because I was relatively young and healthy. And at that time, there was a lot of discussion going on in our country, and the opinion was that COVID-19 was comparable with the flu. And furthermore, our government was sure that we should not get a situation like in Italy, for example, or in the States, New York, but that was later on. Yeah, but unfortunately, the same thing happened in the Netherlands as in New York and Italy. And in March 2020, we were flooded with a lot of patients, and our government decided to lock down, and everyone had to stay home. Schools and offices were closed. Shops, restaurants, sports clubs were closed. Visitors at home were not allowed, and we even had a curfew every evening. And in our hospital, we worked very hard to treat all the patients. And at that time, there was a really extremely high mortality. Many patients died under our hands without us being able to do much about it. And it gave us an enormous feeling of powerlessness. And after 2 weeks of taking care of the very ill patients, I got ill myself and I tested positive for COVID-19. And I stayed home, and every day I got sicker and sicker. And 4 days later, I felt so sick that I asked my husband, please bring me to the ER, because I was so sick. And there I was admitted in isolation on the COVID mart with oxygen, and started with, because that was at that moment the only medication at that time that possibly could influence COVID-19. But unfortunately, my oxygen needs increased, and 4 days later, I was admitted to my own ICU. And that was why I got my first personal experience with delirium.
Wow. So you were a COVID-19 patient in your own ICU.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And I think many of us has probably wondered, what would it be like for me? We know the ICU is a new environment, new experience for most patients. It's really easy to become disoriented in that really foreign setting, surrounded by strangers, but you were in a setting that you absolutely knew. You were surrounded by people that you knew and usually really trust. What was it like for you to have delirium?
Now, for me, the delirium was, I got in the end of the admission in the ICU. But at first, of course, my ICU admission was very stressful for me and my family, but also for my coworkers. Like you said, it's you people you trust. It's also a kind of family. It's your family members, and you are in between your family members. And yeah, initially they put me on high flow nasal oxygen. But I knew that the threat of being ventilated was hanging over my head. And I decided to do everything I could to stay away from it, because I saw so many patients dying. And at that moment, I hadn't seen any patient left from the ICU alive. So I was very anxious. And a few hours later, my colleagues told me that I had to be intubated. And yeah, I had a lot of questions, because who could guarantee that I would survive? And I wasn't ready to die at that moment. And I asked to see my husband. And so my husband was allowed to come for 10 minutes to visit me. So we said goodbye to each other. But I knew afterwards that also a lot of nurses had to cry and about my admission because they were so afraid. It was coming so close to everyone when one of your family members is being ill. Yeah, that can also happen to you because and when it's without your family, you don't have to worry. And it's a kind of going on with stress and anxious situations, I think, in an ICU. So I got intubated, and after my intubation was put in prone position. And then I was transported to another ICU, partly due to because the ICU was full of patients, and partially because of the emotions in our team, because they found it very difficult to take care of me.
Yeah. Wow. I remember hearing stories like that and looking around at my colleagues, some of them in their 60s.
Yeah.
And it was even just imagining taking care of them or them being in one of our beds was really emotional. I'm sure anyone listening to this shudders at imagining having their colleagues, because you love your colleagues. You really are close to them, and having to be in that situation would be really difficult. So it makes sense that why you were transferred.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you were on a propofol drip?
I think in the beginning I was on midazolam because in the beginning there was also probably a shortness of propofol. So yeah. They put all the patients on midazolam. But when I woke up, I was finally put on propofol.
So how long were you on midazolam for? Do you know?
I'm not sure. I was the first period I was spent on the ventilator for 8 days before I woke up. So I'm not sure how many days I was on that, but I know that I used a lot of sedatives, and so I also got clonidine and a lot of opioids to get me.
And what was it like to be sedated?
No, I didn't remember anything from that period because I was prone for a couple of days. And after that, I was turned on my back. And yeah, when I was awake, I was awake. The only thing I remembered is that I was aware of my situation, but I had a lot of pain due to the tube from my mouth. It was very painful. My jaws were very painful. And so I hated the tube, and it was taken out. But unfortunately, due to a strider, I had to re-intubate it. And then they have sedated me with propofol because that should be a very sedation for a patient for only 2 days. And that's why they use propofol. And I asked even the doctors, please give me enough because I really want to sleep because I had so much pain from the tube. So the funny thing is that as an intensivist, I found that every patient had to be awake. And as a patient, I wanted to have more sedatives. So it's just very funny to see the opposites of myself.
And you didn't, and the fact that you didn't have any experiences while sedated, like
no.
it was blank, right?
If you've been listening to this podcast, you're likely convinced that sedation and mobility practices in the ICU need to change. The ICU community is facing incredible difficulty with the trauma from the pandemic, staffing crisis, and burnout. We cannot afford to continue practices that result in poor patient outcomes, more time in the ICU, higher healthcare costs, and greater workload for the ICU team. Yet the prospect of changing decades of beliefs, practices, and culture across all disciplines of the ICU is a daunting task. How does this transformation start? It can begin with a consultation with me to discuss your team's current practices, barriers, and to formulate a plan to help your ICU become an awake and walking ICU. I help teams master the ABCDEF bundle through education, consulting, simulation training, and bedside support. Let's work together to move your team into the future of evidence-based ICU care. Click the link in the show notes of this episode to find out more.
Yeah.
For many patients, they're having active delirium, they're in an alternative world. For you, it was just blank with some mild awareness, right? I mean, that is what we hope for when we sedate patients, but we don't know if that's what they're getting when we do that, right? So that's very fortunate that for you, it was blank.
Yeah, but in the second period on the propofol, I got delirium. And my experience was that I had very lively dreams, but they were all situated around my ICU bed. And they were also not very caring. So, for example, I saw an ICU nurse on the left side doing some things with my infusion pumps. And when I turned my head to the left, the nurse disappeared. And I also saw a very large screen in my room. And the intensivist was communicating through that screen with me. And I was even able to answer the intensivist despite the tube in my mouth. So that was really very strange that I could talk with a tube in my mouth to the intensivist in the screen. Yeah. And I found it very interesting that in between I had perfectly clear moments. So I was awake and then I went down and I went in my lively dreams.
And did you know you were having delirium?
I've written that. I've written that to the nurse and they said, I've never seen a patient who is telling me that they are delirious. So
interesting because I think in absence of doing full CAM screening, we make assumptions. So if someone can follow commands, they're not delirious. Yeah. If someone can write, they're probably not delirious, but that's not accurate. That's interesting. That kind of reinforces the need for full CAM screening.
Yeah, because then I was going down in my delirium again. And then,
but it wasn't scary for you.
No, I saw elephants and they were cutting their ears, but it was not scary. Yeah, it was like flying Dumbo elephants and they were cutting their ears. But I was a stranger. I was far away, so it was not frightening for me. It was like on the screen,
How long did the delirium last?
No, I think it was one evening or one night,
Oh, good. And so that's a really brief period compared to some courses of delirium for patients, right? Sometimes it can last for days to weeks, and it can be very scary and traumatic for them.
Yeah. It was also due to the propofol, I'm not sure.
Right. Because it was, about day 8 or 10 or, around there. And so you'd been in the ICU for a long time and you'd gotten a lot of benzodiazepines. And at some point, everything just kind of collides. What helped your delirium go away?
I think reducing the medication. Yeah.
The clouds parted.
The propofol and the opioids,
How soon after did you mobilize?
Oh, the first time I was mobilized was when the tube was taken out. So it was after 10 days. Then I was able, the physical therapist helped me sitting on the side of the bed. But I think it was only 5 minutes. It was very heavy. For me, it felt like being on a ship in a storm. I was moving.
When I train ICU teams and we're talking about those early stages of mobilizing patients that have been supine and sedated for so long, you have this whole vestibular reacclimation. Our bodies acclimate to being supine. So it is, for many patients, very startling to be upright after being supine for so long. What was it like to realize how weak you were?
Yeah, that's very strange because, I've seen as an intensivist, I've seen that patients had weakness. And so one of the first things that I did when I was awake was looking at my arms and legs to see how they got out of the bedroll. And I was still on the ventilator and I was totally depending on the nurses. But it's very strange to see on yourself that things are really happening, that you, of course, the first thing I wanted to do was typing on my cell phone to get in contact with my family. But I could touch the screen, but I was not able to make words. It looked like I was speaking fluent Russian. And it was also very heavy to do that because my arms were so weak that holding a cell phone in my hand and with two hands doing things on my cell phone was too heavy for me. And it's very strange to experience that kind of things as an intensivist.
And you're completely dependent, totally vulnerable, helpless.
Yeah.
How long did it take to rebuild the ability to walk?
I was moved to my own hospital after I was from the tube. And I've stayed there for 2 days. And then I went to a rehabilitation clinic. And that was they had a special department for COVID-19 patients. And especially COVID-19 patients from the ICU. It means that you went with your oxygen beside your bed, and they did a lot of controls, and they were totally addicted to those kind of severe ill patients on their ward. For me, it was an eye-opener how they run that ward. So I met there several former ICU patients. And what a nice thing was that in the hospital, we didn't have physical therapists because they were all busy in the teams, in the proning teams on the ICU. And on the high care ward, you didn't got any physical therapist. But in the rehab clinic, we got 7 days a week, 3 times a day physical therapy. I made really quick progress. And I think after 12 days, I could go home walking with a stick. But in that rehab clinic, I learned to go in a walking chair and then on walking behind a walker and then still with oxygen. But yeah, after 12 days, I could quit my oxygen. My oxygen needs was zero room air. And yeah, I could go home with a stick. And
That is such a miracle that you had such good rehabilitative services available.
Yeah.
That wasn't the case through a lot of the rest of the world, especially even after the first wave, those services were pretty tapped out, and it was really hard to get patients back home after they had had that point. Many patients, at least in the States, had tracheostomies because they became so weak and debilitated. I'm so glad that you still had such good care during such a crisis. And now you work in a post-ICU clinic, you train ICU nurses and doctors. How has this experience impacted your personal approach to patient care, how you interact with survivors, and then clinicians?
Now, I still experience many symptoms from the post-ICU syndrome, like still having muscle weakness and poor physical condition and also cognitive problems. So unfortunately, I had to quit my job as intensive. So I had to start with a new life and a new working career. So that's why I started with the teaching part. Because before I got ill, I did also a lot of teaching to the residents. And yeah, now I had to start something new. And so it's a little bit difficult to tell my story in daily practice because I cannot work anymore in the ICU. But I try to share my story and the things I have seen as a patient to the nurses. And sometimes I do some rounds and tell my story so people can learn from it.
How do you feel about the ADF bundle rebirth that's happening in the critical care community? I mean, during COVID, we really went back to heavy sedatives, prolonged paralytics, and things like that. Now, in this era, we're really moving towards keeping patients more awake and mobile. You have experienced how uncomfortable the endotracheal tube is. You also experienced post-ICU life. What are your thoughts now about the ABCDF bundle?
I still underscribe this bundle. I really like this bundle, especially because the outcome for the patients is better. For example, with early mobilization, you can prevent the muscle weakness partly. But I'm not sure if you can prevent it for every patient because when you are such a long period in the ICU, I think it's difficult to prevent the muscle weakness and the neuropathy in the patients.
I mean, it's difficult and unlikely that people leave at baseline, like their full capacity, leaving the ICU.
Yeah.
But we can prevent them from really declining or losing a lot of major main function.
Yeah. And for example, the spontaneous breathing trials are, of course, very important to reduce the time of being intubated for patients. And even in a crisis, that can be very helpful because you can use your ICU bed earlier for a next patient.
Absolutely. Yep. That's a big thing that we're talking about in the podcast all the time is decreasing time in the ventilator, decreasing time in the ICU. Because we're in a staffing crisis, even though COVID is over, at least here in the States, we don't have enough staff for our ICU. So keeping patients on the vent in the beds longer is really a burden on our entire system, especially our staff. Anything else you would share with the ICU community?
Now, I want to tell the ICU community about delirium, that delirium is not something that is associated automatically with an ICU admission. It's a manifestation of acute encephalopathy, which is caused by various underlying processes like a new infection or sedatives. And it's part of the multi-organ failure that we see in ICU patients. And if the ICU community is aware of that, you can even use the delirium to know the patients even better and to recognize new problems during their ICU stay. And treatment of underlying causes can help to fast recovery, for example, and hopefully less implications after the recovery of the critical illness. And furthermore, I had an ICU diary, and I think an ICU diary can help patients very good to fill in their gaps, to get better understanding about their disease and their delirium, because I spoke to a lot of patients, formerly ICU patients during COVID, during my rehab, and for them it was all one black hole without any family, because it was not, visitors were not allowed in the hospitals. So it's very difficult then to know what has happened in the ICU and even on the ward.
Absolutely. And it's so nice to hear that from a survivor, those that actually have and use their diaries, because some of the research is a little bit conflicting as far as the impact of ICU diaries, but to have actual survivors talk about how much it means to them after such a traumatic experience, that's pretty compelling. I love everything you've shared, that this is, I love the term acute brain failure. It's part of the multi-organ failure happening within the body. And I think when patients are in nursing homes, geriatric patient becomes confused, combative. We start looking at why. Did they have a UTI? It's always our first thought. But in the ICU, when they become confused acutely or things change, we just shrug our shoulders and say it's part of their ICU stay. But really, it could be a sign of something happening. So I love it. Seen as a warning sign, a symptom that requires investigation. I think your experience as an intensivist, then a patient, and now an educator and now a survivor is so valuable. Please keep teaching us. Thank you so much for everything that you've shared.
Yeah, you're welcome. It was a nice talk to you.
Thank you.
Schedule a consultation for your ICU, as well as find supportive resources such as the free ebook, case studies, episode citations, and transcripts, please check out the website www.daytonicuconsulting.com.